From the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Josh Kranzberg, in for Jason McClure. This year marks the 50th anniversary of one of the most controversial periods in China's history, the beginning of the Cultural Revolution. Communist Party leader Mao Zedong, concerned that the country was straying too far from its political ideologies, so he launched the Cultural Revolution, shutting down the nation's schools and universities and rallying young people to call out people for embracing what he felt was bourgeois values and not the party. This movement exploded as the students formed paramilitary groups called the Red Guard, targeting the country's intellectual population. During this time, the president and other communist leaders, including people like Deng Xiaoping, who would later return as the country's president, and the father of current president Xi Jinping, were removed from power, with some being imprisoned. The Chinese economy tanked, with industrial production dropping 12% from 1966 to 1968. When all was said and done, around 1.5 million people were killed, and millions more were imprisoned or tortured for their beliefs. On this edition of Global Journalist, we look at the lasting impact of the Cultural Revolution and how it is being felt today. We have a packed show today, so let's get right to our first guest. Joining us from Qingdao, China, is Dongping Han. He is a professor of politics at Warren Wilson College. He's also the author of The Unknown Cultural Revolution, Life and Change in a Chinese Village. Sir, welcome to Global Journalist. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Joshua, thank you.
So let's just get right to it. You grew up in a rural village during the Cultural Revolution. How did it come to your village? And just talk to me about that.
Okay. And the Cultural Revolution is very, very controversial, as you just pointed out. But I want to tell you, many, many scholars and many, many people in the West, they discussed, they focused their attention on the small minority who suffered during the Cultural years. But they missed the point. The Cultural Revolution was to empower Chinese workers and farmers. And I was 11 years old when the Cultural Revolution was started. And I grew up in the village. And the Cultural Revolution in the village started by studying Mao's works. So the Chinese farmers, the Chinese workers, learned how to use Mao's writings and to empower themselves to criticize the Chinese leaders, the village leaders and the factory leaders and the commune leaders, county leaders. And these people used to be very, very powerful before the Cultural Revolution years. They order people around and they have a lot of power and authority. But the Cultural Revolution changed that. Mao's words empowered Chinese farmers to criticize their leaders. And they demand their leaders to do things according to Mao's instructions. They want the leader to work with them. They want their leader to live the same lifestyle as they do. And I think that part of the Cultural Revolution, many, many people in the West missed. And the farmers wanted their leader to work with them. That's a very, very important point.
So you say the farmers wanted people to work with them. Talk to me about how the revolution changed the education and the healthcare system in your small village.
Okay, you just said the Cultural Revolution shut down the Chinese schools. That's not accurate, actually. And the Chinese, in the countryside, the school never shut down. And the primary school, the middle school never shut down. They continued throughout the Chinese Cultural Revolution years. They never stopped. Actually, I mentioned in my book, the educational system in the countryside was reformed and expanded. And before the Cultural Revolution years, most Chinese villages didn't have schools. And usually several villages share one primary school. But during the Cultural Revolution years, every village in my county and throughout China set up their own primary school. Every farmer's child was able to go to primary school free of charge. And in my county, I studied. Before the Cultural year, there were only seven middle school. It was very hard for farmers' children to go to middle school. But during the Cultural years, middle school expanded greatly in my hometown, Jima County. we used to have salmon. At the end of cod production in 1976, we had 249 middle schools.
Wow.
So every farmer's...
I'm sorry, I was going to say, so you corrected me or you dispute that they closed down, that China closed down many of its schools for the Cultural Revolution. What other misconceptions do you think there are about the Cultural Revolution in American media or even Chinese media?
I think the oil strategy, the Cultural Revolution, was a disaster as far as education is concerned. But they failed to see the education in the countryside greatly expanded. I just mentioned, middle school in my hometown, Jima County, grew from 7 to 249. For high school, we had only one high school before the Cultural Revolution years. But by the end of Cultural Revolution, we had 89.
Wow.
Everybody who graduated from middle school were able to go to high school without screening or examinations. We went from middle school to high school directly. And before the Cultural Revolution years, for 17 years in my county, the high school system only trained 1,500 high school graduates. So we have 1,050 villages in my county. Not even one village, not each village didn't have even one high school graduate. By the time the Cultural Revolution ended in 1976, every village had more than 100 high school graduates.
Wow. So how do you think contemporary Chinese leaders, such as Xi Jinping, are handling the history of the Cultural Revolution, and how do you think they can effectively use that as a way to advance the country?
I think people forget we live in a class society. Some class suffered during the Cultural Revolution years, and some class benefited greatly during the Cultural Revolution years. I think a small minority of people suffered during the Cultural Revolution years, but the majority of Chinese people, farmers, workers, benefited tremendously from the Cultural Revolution years. And the Chinese President Xi Jinping tried to balance the two parts of the Chinese modern contemporary Chinese history. He said people cannot use the first 30 years to negate the later 30 years of reform, but they are also vice versa. But I think there's very big controversy in China. The Chinese working class are still very fond of Mao's memory. They were very angry with Chinese official corruptions. And they also were angry with the gap between rich and poor in China. And the Chinese officials, of course, on the other hand, were very, very scared of the Cultural Revolution years. Because during the Cultural Revolution years, the empowered working class did ask the officials to live like them, like the Chinese working class. And today, they live very, very differently. It would be very hard for Chinese government to reconcile the two groups of people in China. Hmm.
Well, Dongping Han, thank you so much for joining us on Global Journalist. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
A reminder, this is Global Journalist. I'm Josh Kranzberg in for Jason McClure. This week, a look at the 50th anniversary of China's Cultural Revolution, a controversial time in the country's history that is still having impact in China today. Joining us now from Washington, D.C., Bethany Allen Ibrahimian, an assistant editor for Foreign Policy Magazine's China Channel, Tea Leaf Nation. From Baltimore, Joel Andreas, an associate professor at Johns Hopkins University. He's also the author of Rise of the Red Engineers, The Cultural Revolution and the Rise of China's New Class. And from London, Roderick McFarker, the Leroy B. Williams Research Professor of History and Political Science at Harvard. He has written a number of books on the Cultural Revolution. Welcome to all of you to Global Journalists. We really appreciate you all coming on the show. Mr. McFarker, I'm going to start with you. You have traced the origins of the Cultural Revolution in your scholarship and your many, many works. Can you briefly describe to us what you consider the main strains that caused the Cultural Revolution to even come about in the first place?
I think the most important strain behind the Cultural Revolution was the decision by Mao, reached over the course of many years of relationship with the Soviet Union, that the founders of the Soviet Union had been deserted by the current leadership, notably by Nikita Khrushchev and his denunciation of Stalin. And as the years went by, he argued that the Stalinists had been thrown out and that Khrushchev was restoring capitalism to the Soviet Union. And what he was determined to do in the Cultural Revolution, and this is why it was called the Cultural Revolution, was to reinvigorate the ideas of Lenin and Stalin among Chinese youth and other Chinese in order to prevent what he called the slide back into capitalism that the Soviet Union was experiencing.
Joel Andreas, in your book and in your studies, you use Tsinghua University, the premier university in China, as a case study. Could you briefly talk to us about what happened there and how it affected the rest of the country?
Well, Tsinghua became such a target because it was training a new generation of red experts. They had been seriously doing this from the time the Communist Party took power to take charge of the country, to really run the country. Mao was very uncomfortable with this idea of a new generation of red experts taking, becoming a new class, becoming a new bureaucratic, he began calling them at the time of the Cultural Revolution, a new bureaucratic class that would be separated from the people. And would this would be the product of the Communist Revolution then, that it would put a new class in power. He was very uncomfortable with that idea. That's what he meant by restoring capitalism in China, was putting this new class of really, it was composed of two groups that were coming together. One was the old educated elite, that were the old property classes, really, because it was really a very small part of the Chinese population that had education, and those were the same, it was the property classes. They had taken their property away. Property was no longer distinguishing one class from another in China. It was all public property now. But they still had education, and that put them in a very powerful position, not politically powerful, but of course they were very, very important to running all the institutions in China, including the universities. The other group that was at the top, of course, was the communist officials. These folks were mostly from peasant background. They were not very educated. They were quite capable in terms of they took over the country militarily, and they were now running the country, very capable administrators, but they were not very educated. They had political power. So these were, there were really two elites, two distinct elites, the cultural elite or the educated elite and the political elite. Mao was very concerned about these two elites coming together and becoming a new class of red experts, particularly their children becoming a new class of red experts. That's one reason he targeted the universities in general and Tsinghua University in particular.
So Bethany Allen Ibrahimian, all that said, with all of these changes, what do you think are the most apparent outcomes or results that are still being felt today from the Cultural Revolution?
You know, I think that starting in the 90s and up till today, you see some of the arguments, not of the Cultural Revolution, but of the memory of the Cultural Revolution. This is something that I think that Dongping mentioned, that there's a group of people in China today who remember it with great nostalgia and wish, you know, almost that they could go back to that time, or that, you know, today's leaders in China have, you know, have betrayed the Cultural Revolution or have betrayed Mao. You know, it's, there's a group called the New Left. And in China, you know, you see this on the internet, in you know, discussions of people. It's almost like in the U.S. we have, you know, the culture wars that pit the liberals versus the conservatives, and in China you have, you know, the new left and you have the liberals, and they argue with each other about a lot of things. But one of the things they argue about is the Cultural Revolution. And so sometimes, you know, every once in a while, online, you know, in social media, there'll be these waves of arguments about whether the Cultural Revolution was good or bad. So that's one thing that's still alive in China today.
Well,
Bethany, I am curious,
if you don't mind me jumping in, I just out of curiosity, you talk about people almost wishing that it happened again. You know, numbers may vary, but more than 1 million people died. How can people sort of square that away, saying we want this to happen again, when it was a pretty violent time back then?
I don't think anyone wants it to happen again. I think that some people view that period with nostalgia. You know, people who in that, I remember, you know, I've spoken with, you know, people who were in their 40s and 50s, who really were too young to remember it, but they've heard about it. They've heard about the values. You know, people from lower class backgrounds, you know, people who've come in from the countryside who, you know, have heard that people during that time, people like them had power and they could, you know, they could criticize leaders and they could try to change things. And now they oftentimes feel like they don't have that power. They don't have that equality. I personally think that sometimes, you know, distance makes the heart grow fonder, as they say, that people who are nostalgic for it have forgotten or don't remember the horrible chaos and pain of it. In reality, when there's great economic chaos, people who suffer the most economically are still going to be the poor people. I think they did suffer. I on that note, I would really like to hear, you know, we heard Deng Ping say that maybe the majority of people in China benefited from the Cultural Revolution. And I would really enjoy hearing Roderick's and Joel's opinions on that.
Roderick, let me turn it over to you.
I think that the great majority of people in China did not enjoy the Cultural Revolution. Quite apart from the chaos in the cities in the first two or three years, when it was violence was irrational, the population was volatile, and you never knew when you might be assaulted, unless you were a bourgeois. In fact, you were probably assaulted at the very beginning. But the Mao was himself compelled by the violence continuing in the cities and in the universities to put down the Red Guards in 1968. Effectively, he said, you've let me down. He had hoped that they would evolve into a new revolutionary governing class eventually, and he found that they were just engaged in internecine warfare. So I don't think anyone remembers that period in the city, certainly, with nostalgia. The countryside, as we've heard, things could be very different. And I think if there's something we must remember at this anniversary, it's this. What Mao did was something unprecedented in Chinese history and probably in the history of any country. A man who created a state tore down the major institution of that state, namely the Communist Party, and allowed society to have free range against the state. Now, that is a lesson, that is a historical episode, which can never be put back in the bottle. And I think one reason why there's nostalgia now for those people old enough to remember that period is that it is the first time in Chinese history that the bureaucracy as an institution ruling the country has been questioned by the leadership and the society has been allowed to attack it. And society has never gone back in the bottle. To this day, there are demonstrations in various parts of the country. One Chinese estimate is 500 a day, because people no longer respect the authority of the party unless it's delivering the goods. And this is something which can't be restrained, even with Xi Jinping trying to restore order. This memory will not go back in the bottle.
Joel, let me turn that to you before we get to our break. What is your reaction to that?
Well, I think Roderick is absolutely correct that the Cultural Revolution changed things once and for all. The relationship between the Communist Party cadres, the leadership in each work unit, in every place in the country, in schools and factories and villages, their relationship with the students and the workers and the peasants was changed once and for all. They never had the same kind of authority that they did before the Cultural Revolution, and that's because Mao called on the students and workers and peasants to attack the leaders in their own villages and schools and workplaces and factories, which it was an absolutely, as Roderick said, an absolutely unique type of political episode. It turned for that reason. I think, like I was saying, they attacked both the cultural elites, the educated elites, and the political elites. They had been attacking the cultural elites, who were also the property elites, ever since the Communist Party came to power. And that wasn't particularly problematic during the Cultural Revolution. A lot of people suffered. What made the Cultural Revolution so problematic, so difficult, so violent, and so torn apart by factions was because they attacked the political elite. They attacked the communist cadres who were running the country. I don't think that Mao's purpose, his idea in the beginning was that the Red Guards were actually going to take over, or these rebel groups that he launched were going to actually take over and become a new, take over the institutions. They used that kind of rhetoric. He used the rhetoric about power seizure. They actually did overthrow the communist authorities in every factory, in every village, in every school, in every work unit in the country. And they paralyzed the Communist Party for 2 years. Nevertheless, I think Mao's intention the whole time was to reform the Communist Party, to reform the officials by subjecting them to this kind of criticism and this kind of attack. It ended up in a tremendous, violent factional upheaval.
A quick reminder that this is Global Journalist. I'm Josh Kranzberg in for Jason McClure. This week, a look at the 50th anniversary of China's Cultural Revolution, a controversial time in the country's history that is still having impact in China today. Our guests this week from Washington, D.C., Bethany Allen Ibrahimian, an assistant editor for Foreign Policy Magazine's China Channel, Tea Leaf Nation. From Baltimore, Maryland, Joel Andreas, an associate professor at Johns Hopkins University, also the author of Rise of the Red Engineers, The Cultural Revolution and the Rise of China's New Class. And from London, Roderick McFarker, the Leroy B. Williams Research Professor of History and Political Science at Harvard. He is also the author of numerous books about the Cultural Revolution. If you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read our ongoing series of interviews with journalists in exile around the world and coverage of foreign affairs and press freedom issues. You can also check us out on social media. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at GlobalJourn. Bethany, I want to go to you. Can you briefly compare the coverage of this 50th anniversary of the Cultural Revolution in Chinese media versus international media? I know the media landscape is vastly different even now than it was a few years ago, but how are they covering things there?
Right. Well, there was very little coverage of the 50th anniversary of the Cultural Revolution in China. I think, as we all know, Chinese media is tightly controlled. State media is, you know, directly under the control of the party. And there's a great deal of censorship, both online and in terms of, you know, print publications. So there was very little. There was one editorial in, I believe it was the People's Daily, which is the party flagship newspaper. You know, and it basically it repeated what has been said about the Cultural Revolution officially for, you know, two decades, which is it wasn't a great thing and it can never happen again. It will never happen again. We need to not worry about that. Online, you know, people, you know, now with the rise of the internet and the social media, you know, people can go online, they have blogs, they have, you know, something similar to Twitter, and they can write about it. And what we saw on May 16th was that there was a huge peak in online censorship. So, you know, people were trying to talk about it, people were trying to blog about it, and their posts were being deleted by China's small army of online censors. Obviously, you know, free media, you know, Western media, media outside of China had vastly different and vastly more coverage of it, partially because people in China or Chinese people outside of China are able to write freely. And so there were quite a number of personal narratives, you know, that you could read, like people's experiences or, you know, children of people who were in the Cultural Revolution. You had lots of, you know, I'd say all major media outlets had some kind of coverage of it. So obviously it was hugely different. So I think there's a misunderstanding that you can't, there's a misunderstanding outside of China that you can't talk about the Cultural Revolution inside of China. And that's not true. You can. It's mentioned. You know, that word is, you see it sometimes. People do mention it, but it's very superficially discussed. You can only say a few things about it before you start encroaching on taboo territory. It can even be brought up in movies. You know, there was a movie last year called Wolf Totem, and the whole movie took place during the Cultural Revolution. But there's very little discussion of what actually happened, you know, the larger political trends. So it's something that everyone knows about, but, you know, yet the younger generation, unless they really try to find out about it, may not have a very deep understanding outside of what they were taught in school, of the very, very basics.
Roderick McFarker, with only a few minutes left. So we talked about how Chinese media covers this. They have called the Cultural Revolution an error that, quote, we cannot and will not allow a repeat performance of, as Bethany mentioned. However, Professor Han earlier in the show noted the revolution brought significant improvement to the lives of peasants. How do you think the country as a whole balances the legacy of the Cultural Revolution?
The country as a whole doesn't do anything about the Cultural Revolution because there's no discussion. As as we've just heard, there's really no discussion in the Chinese press. There are a few specialists who have ways of discussing it among themselves, but people do not discuss the Cultural Revolution. They discuss their ordinary lives because they've got no time for the Cultural Revolution, and they're not supposed to discuss it. It's a banned subject. I taught a course on the Cultural Revolution for many years at Harvard, and in the later years, when we started to get undergraduates from China, they would come up to me, some of them, at the end of the course and thank me because their parents, their grandparents, had never taught them about the Cultural Revolution. Now, part of that reason may be that parents don't want to get their kids into trouble. Part of it may be that they themselves participated in the Cultural Revolution in unpleasant ways, and they don't want to tell their children about that. But the fact is that unless they come to the West, most Chinese will not learn about the Cultural Revolution.
So how do you think that leaders in China can work the legacy of this?
The legacy is that we can see this in the behavior of Xi Jinping. Xi Jinping has launched massive campaigns, campaigns that are as massive in their way as some of the campaigns which Mao launched in his time. But what is very interesting about them, take the anti-corruption campaign, which is the main one. What is interesting is that there is no public participation requested or allowed. If someone publicly says, oh, official X is corrupt, and here's my evidence for it, that whistleblower will be either put in prison or made to shut up somehow. Because what they don't want is for a campaign to get out of hand like they feel the Cultural Revolution got out of hand, because Mao actually wanted to get out of hand. He wanted young people to learn to make revolution by making revolution. He did not want to direct them to do it. That was the objective. And so Xi Jinping is trying to keep that under wraps by not allowing any public participation in his campaigns except as directed by him.
Joel Andreas, with about 45 seconds left, I know this will be a complicated answer in the time frame, but how does the Cultural Revolution help us understand modern China today?
Oh, like I said, the relationship between the Communist Party and the population changed fundamentally during the Cultural Revolution, and it will never be the same. I think that Roderick, once again, is very right. They're continuing to have problems. What the Cultural Revolution was about was the Communist Party trying to control its own cadres in some ways. Mao trying to control their own cadres, control corruption, but trying to control their privileged nature, etc. It's very similar in some ways to Xi Jinping's battle today against corruption, only which I think he's very serious about. He wants to battle corruption. Only he, like Roderick said, he does not want to involve the masses in it at all. And any involvement of the masses for the party, they denounce this basically as it will lead to the chaos of the Cultural Revolution. Mao was precisely the opposite view. He wanted the masses to be involved, and he wanted them to lower the cadres down a peg, is basically, I think, what the purpose of the Cultural Revolution was.
Well, that'll do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri-Columbia. Many thanks to Dongping Han, Bethany Allen Ibrahimian, Joel Andreas, and Roderick McBarker for joining us this week. Our producer this week is Javila Roscoe-Skate. Our studio director is Travis McMillan from RJI, and our audio engineer is Kyle Felling from KDIA. From all of us here at Global Journalist, I'm Josh Kranzberg. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next week.